You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The labor movement has a 200-year history in the United States, but a lot of the stories of the people behind that movement don't always get told. Our next guest reports on the modern-day labor movement, and in her new book, she shares stories of the people, past and present, who organized their workplaces and led strikes. And she highlights the role of women, people of color, immigrants, and the LGBTQ community, who often led the way in grassroots labor organizing. From young women at textile mills in the early 1800s to people like Amazon employee Jennifer Bates testifying last year before Congress on union organizing efforts.
We hope that they will start to hear us and see us and treat us like human beings. It's frustrating that all we want is to make Amazon a better place to work. Yet Amazon is acting like they are under attack. Maybe if they spent less time and money trying to stop the union, they would hear what we are saying. And maybe they would create a company that's as good for workers in our community as it is for the shareholders and executives.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a part of a union or a union organizing effort at some place in your life or some kind of informal workplace organizing activity? Do you have thoughts? Do you have questions about the history of labor here in the United States? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kim Kelly is a freelance writer reporting on labor, class, politics, and culture. She's the author of the new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we go into the history, Kim, your book is bookended by two modern-day movements, Amazon in your setup and a still ongoing coal mine strike in Alabama now. And you, in reporting on this, got to meet a lot of the organizers. Can you talk about what you heard from them that inspired you to dig into this history?
Yes, of course. I mean, I'd already been interested in labor history for a while. It's what I've been covering in my career as a labor reporter. It's a personal interest. But really, spending time in Alabama over the past year, well, over a year now, really just drove home this idea that, like, okay, I have this opportunity, I have this platform, I need to use it to elevate the voices of workers like Jennifer Bates or like Braxton Wright, like the coal miners and the warehouse workers, and the Starbucks workers in Birmingham right now, who are all working together and trying to make their communities better and safer and more fulfilling, who are pushing up against these corporate interests and these bad bosses and these oligarchs who are trying to siphon away every drop of profit from this area and take it away, take it out of Alabama and away from the people who created it. And it's just been a really incredible experience getting to know folks in rural Alabama and in Birmingham who are leading this movement the way that they have for decades, if not centuries, even if the history books don't always reflect how important their role has been.
And I grew up in southeastern Michigan, auto industry country. And I guess if I thought, you know, union, it would be a bunch of mostly men, a big auto factory, mostly white in my neck of the woods there. And that's part of the story you're trying to correct. There's a lot of variety, a lot of diversity in the people who were fundamental in this 200-year effort.
Yes, we've always been here, you know, I'm also very familiar with the trope of the, you know, the white guy in a hard hat, because that's who raised me. My family, I'm from a very rural blue collar union family in South Jersey. Everyone's a construction worker, or a steel worker, or a teacher. Like, the union is always part of my life. And it wasn't until I kind of moved out of the woods and got to know more people and learned more about our collective histories, I realized, like, wow, this movement is so diverse and so multiracial, multiethnic, multigender. Every type of person has been involved in this long, sometimes very slow march towards progress, but they haven't always gotten top billing. I think it's easier for some folks, some institutions, to act as though the working class is just that guy like my dad, the factory worker, the auto worker, the person who's a little more conservative, doesn't care about social issues. But that's simply not the case. And it's never been the case. Even with, you know, auto workers in Michigan, the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, and the Palestinian workers and Arab workers who organized with Black workers in the 60s to fight for better working conditions and for social causes. Like, that is such an important part of that history. It just doesn't get quite as much of a spotlight. So I wanted to make sure that I shined it on it real bright.
Well, and to that end, one of the first stories you share is in the early 1800s, the first maybe strike in the United States. They didn't even have the word strike then. Young women working in the textile industry. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, I think it was 1824. I think they called it a turnout back then. Just young women working in the mills who knew they were being exploited, they're being treated poorly, they're being paid poorly. They were, at that point, it was mostly young white women, farmers' daughters from the local New England area, who had seized on this opportunity to work in these mills as a way to build, you know, financial and social independence in a way that hadn't really been available to them before. And they were really excited for that opportunity, but were quickly kind of crushed and grounded to dust by the realities of what it's like to work in a mill. And they organized, they fought back, they went on strike. And they really kicked off what would become centuries of organizing and picketing and striking and just fighting like hell against the people who are benefiting from our labor but aren't willing to share any piece of those profits.
Talking to Kim Kelly, her new book is called Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jim is with us in Juneau. Jim, hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. So I've been a union worker for quite a while, and I'm from down south, so there's not a lot of strong unions down there. I went through this thing up here in Wisconsin where all these people were fighting like hell to get this right to work state. I want to tell you the people out there that are listening that are not in the union, don't be foolish. Your wages, the ones that get you through, that make it so that you can feed your kids, pay your bills, and all that, were brought up because they had to have a wage that would compete with what the union workers were making, because if they didn't, they would have lost union workers. You make a strong union, you make a strong community.
Jim, thanks for the call. Kim?
I mean, hell yeah, brother. That's exactly right. I mean, that's the thing. Building worker power, building working class power and community power, that's how we take care of ourselves and protect ourselves. Rising tide lifts those boats, and being part of the labor movement is just one, it's if not the most important way for a regular working class person to join with your coworkers and actively make their own lives as well as their coworkers' lives better. Like, it's just, it's a collective effort, and you're exactly right. It's one of the best tools we've got.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to move ahead a little bit in history, Kim. Post-Civil War, black workers, former slaves, organizing, sharecroppers, women who clean houses. Can you share a story or two of their efforts and the backlash they faced?
Of course. I mean, one of the most significant moments from that piece of history, I think hopefully a lot of folks know about them, and if they don't, they should read up, the Washerwomen of Jackson, black domestic workers who were women who organized and basically compelled, well, they demanded higher wages, standardized wages from the white employers who were way too comfortable and way too used to not paying them anything at all and to exploiting them and to really just not acknowledging the value of their labor and their humanity. They organized and they sent this open letter, and they made it very clear that we are united. We're an organization. We are going to push for what we deserve. They really set the stage for what would be really decades of more organizing, whether it's black workers in the post-Reconstruction South or immigrant workers in other parts of the country. Folks who have been the most marginalized have always had to push the hardest, but have fought the hardest too, because they started out with so much less.
And also on the backlash side of things, you write about sharecroppers who tried to organize to get, you know, more of a share of the cotton they raised, and were met with violence. Can you share a little of that story?
Oh, God. The Elaine Massacre, I think. I'm trying to remember the exact year. It's been a couple of years since I wrote the book, but it was, as you said, I think it was the bloodiest, if not one of the bloodiest, racist massacres in U.S. history. Essentially, a group of black farmers got together and they tried to organize and demand higher prices, standardized prices for their product. And in response, I mean, they held a union meeting, they engaged a lawyer, they were forming a union. But in response, white sheriffs and, you know, white men in the county, in the town, they came out and they ambushed the meeting. They shot up the church where the meeting was being held. And when some of the workers shot back in self-defense, the racist lawmen and racist white people in the town decided that that constituted a conspiracy, an uprising, rebellion. And they massacred hundreds of people. They arrested dozens. They tried to basically condemn, I think it was 12 men to death, some of whom weren't even there or involved in the union. Ida B. Wells, the pioneering investigative journalist and anti-lynching crusader, she wrote a pamphlet about it. And she really helped bring attention to their cause and to their plight. And she went down to visit those men and she snuck into the jail posing as a family member to get their stories. Like she was one of my favorite labor reporters on top of being one of the most important journalists in American history. So it's the kind of history in this country that is hidden and is really ugly and is really poorly known, but it's just so important and so instrumental in understanding the past as well as our current moment in time.
We're talking to Kim Kelly, author of the book Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, sharing stories of the history of the union and the people involved in labor organizing over the last 200 years or so. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for a guest or a story to share, 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Kim Kelly, author of the book Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor, looking at the labor movement, its history, some of the people who made it happen over the last two centuries. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Cassandra is with us in Milwaukee. Cassandra, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up, I know you were mentioning in the book, like, information about Amazon and how Amazon doesn't want to unionize. And I won't say the pleasure of working at Amazon, because it really is, they expect a lot of their employees and don't do a lot for them and don't advocate for them. But I've also had the pleasure of working for UPS that is unionized. And it honestly makes a big difference. A lot of people want to hone in on, like, the dues and that they need the money, but, like, the money is here to protect you, so that if something were to happen, like, someone's on, like, standing behind you, supporting you, making sure that you're not going to lose your job. You know, when I moved up into a supervisor position at UPS, that I was no longer a part of the union, I was going to the union reps to advocate for my employees, because upper management just does not care. So I really wanted to stress to people, like, I've worked at Amazon and I've worked at UPS, and I can tell you 110% that being a union member is way better when in a warehouse setting. If not, you are going to endure a lot of abuse.
Cassandra, hi. Thanks a lot for that call. Kim, is that a story you've heard a lot from people?
I mean, the union difference is a very real thing. Cassandra's exactly right. Not only is it building solidarity with your coworkers and feeling that community and feeling like someone has your back, it's very literally having an entity with resources and legal power and, you know, some heft that's there for you if something goes wrong, whether they need to enforce a union contract that they bargain for you, or you get hurt on the job, they show up, make sure you get what you're owed. Like, it's really just having someone in your corner. And I think a lot of union members, myself included, would agree that even with the dues, like, that's priceless. Like, what you get back, you can't put a price on, knowing someone is there for you.
Cassandra, thanks for the call. Laura joins us now in Wisconsin Dells. Laura, hi.
Hi. This is a great topic. And as an educational union member, I support the concept. And I'm just curious if in your research you looked into corruption within unions themselves. I mean, I remember the Jimmy Hoffa days. And I'm curious, who's monitoring how the unions spending their money?
Laura, thanks for the call. Kim, concerns about, especially in that Jimmy Hoffa era, corruption in unions?
Boy, that is a big topic, one that honestly is a little above my pay grade. I didn't focus as much on internal union politics and internal union practices in this book. There are a lot of great reporters that do. The Teamsters show up my book a few times, but when I wrote about them, I was writing about actually, you know, there was this moment when during the Coors boycott, when they were trying to get other members of a community to come out and support them. They're trying to get Black and Brown community members. They're trying to get queer community members to come out and support this boycott. And at first, it didn't work because people didn't trust them because they had heard the stories. They had heard about Jimmy Hoffa. They'd heard about racism and corruption. They didn't trust this union. And the union had to put in extra effort and hire organizers from those communities and really focus on outreach and really show that, no, we mean it. Like, this company, Coors, are discriminating against a lot of different people. They're harming all of us in different ways. We get it. We're trying to do better, you know, and it took extra work, but they put in that effort, and the Coors boycott lasted for decades. So I think there's definitely room for improvement in a lot of unions in this country, but thankfully there are a lot of people who are trying to make them more transparent and more equitable and just better for everyone. So you got to have some hope, I guess.
Laura, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Kim Kelly is with us talking about her book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Back to your calls. Debbie is with us at The Villages in Florida. Debbie, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say I am a union supporter. I grew up in the Detroit area, and so unions were always very strong. And that may have been what gave unions a bad name in the last 20 years, because they would defend people who can't be defended for what they're doing. For instance, I know of one person who is in electrical union that he doesn't show up for work and there's no repercussions. I know somebody else that doesn't show up for work. He was in the at the Ford plant and there's no repercussions. And when you defend something like that, you lose your credibility in being, I'm working for you. It isn't good for unions, and it isn't good for the companies.
Debbie, thanks for the call. And Kim, this is an accusation, I think, of unions, especially at their peak, that they might go beyond protecting workers and, as Debbie says, protect workers who aren't such great workers.
I think that's a common criticism and talking point that you hear, especially when people who don't support unions. It's just kind of a way to break them down and act as though they're a bad thing. They're not useful. They're not out to actually help people. And honestly, you know, not all union locals are created equal. Unions are not a monolith. The labor movement's not a monolith. I'm sure there's folks in here there who aren't doing the best job they could, just like I'm sure there's union members who aren't doing the best job they could. But I don't think it helps anybody to act as though isolated incidents of workers not behaving or union officials acting badly to condemn the whole movement, because by and large, unions and labor movement are a good thing, and they've lifted up so many people in this country out of poverty and into what's left of the middle class. There's definitely housekeeping that could be done. There's definitely people on both sides of that could pull their weight a little bit more, but I would never condemn the movement just because a couple people take advantage, you know?
Debbie, thanks for the call. Jim in Mequon called in, couldn't stay on the line. Wants to know what you think about unions being accused of being socialist entities at various points in history, that this is a inherently socialist activity.
Well, I mean, some unions have been socialists. There have been a lot of socialists and anarchists, communists, progressives and radicals of every stripe have been a part of this movement. And whether or not people like to think about that, some of those very people have been some of the most important and impactful leaders. Unions aren't inherently a left-wing thing or a right-wing thing. The right-wing is not particularly interested in the working class, let alone working class power. That's more of a capitalist, pro-business, anti-worker side of things. So sure, if you want to look at unions as an inherently left-wing thing in this country, by all means. But I mean, even at that question is sort of insinuating that socialism or being lefty is a bad thing. And of course it's not. And I mean, it's like it's acting as though FDR and Francis Perkins and policies like Social Security and all of the worker protections that came with the New Deal, that's acting as though like that's a bad thing because Francis Perkins was a socialist. And there are a lot of unions who are much more conservative, if not some might say too conservative, in the current movement. Like I said, labor movement is not a monolith. It's made up of people. People have different views. People have different goals. I would certainly hope that we're all on the same side when it comes to building working class power and lifting people up. But, you know, it takes all types, we'll say.
Just briefly in our last minute or so, Kim, one story that wasn't finished by the time your book was done and still isn't finished is this coal mine strike that hasn't gotten a ton of media attention going on in Alabama. And I think, as you described them, these are not what we would consider left-wing socialist workers in this strike. Can you give us just a taste of the latest there?
Yeah, I mean, it's been over a year. We're coming up, I think it's a year and almost 3 months. I have the 500-day mark circled on my calendar. It's coming up quick. 1,000 coal miners with the UMWA workers in Brookwood, Alabama have been out on an unfair labor practices strike since April 1st of last year. They're striking for better pay, safer working conditions, more time off with their families, really basic asks that they had had in a previous contract but were pulled away when a big Wall Street-backed company came in and bought up the mine and shook everything up. And they really need solidarity. They need support. They need as much as we can do for them because they've kind of been forgotten. It's an interesting story with lots of different nuances to it. A lot of those folks are conservative. They are Republican and Christian, and they love their union. You know, the labor movement is a really good way to see, to really illuminate the gray areas that exist in our alleged political divide and see the common ground that normal working class people can find for themselves. For a lot of those folks, it's a union, it's fighting for your coworkers, and it's fighting for what's fair. And ultimately, isn't that what everybody wants?
We'll leave it there, Kim. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. And the callers, thank you too.
That's Kim Kelly, author of the new book, Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Coming up after the news, when's the last time you visited your local shopping mall? We'll talk to a design critic about the life and possible death and maybe rebirth of shopping malls. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The shopping mall started off as a uniquely American institution. You might have spent some of your childhood there. Cue a 1980s mall commercial.
Bayshore Mall has something special in your mailbox. 20% off coupons that you can redeem at any participating store Thursday through Sunday. The beach goes on with savings, fashion, food, and fun.
It's a mall commercial from back in 1988, in some ways the heyday of shopping malls. But malls faded in popularity over the years. There were too many of them. Big box stores added competition. Then internet shopping and the pandemic came along. But hold on. Our next guest says malls aren't dead. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you spend a lot of time in malls maybe during your childhood? Do you shop in them a lot in your adulthood? Do you have a story about a memorable time you had shopping or working at a mall? Is there a future for them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra Lang is a design critic. Her writing has been published in places including Harvard Design Magazine, the New York Times, and the Atlantic. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Alexandra, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I love that ad.
Now, you and I are roughly the same age. I won't reveal it to people, but I was a kid. I was a teenager in an era where going to the mall was just a thing you would do, not to buy anything necessarily. It was an attraction, and that was part of your growing up too.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up in North Carolina, and what did you do when you wanted to meet your friends on a weekend afternoon? You went to the mall. Like, maybe you went to the movies, maybe you went to the food court, maybe you just walked around and looked at things. But that was the place to go. And I think that was true for basically millions of kids, especially those who grew up in the 80s and 90s.
Now, your book isn't just a trip through nostalgia, though. What led you to decide to study malls from, a design critic standpoint?
Well, I had read a lot of the stories about the death of the mall, but at the same time, I read other stories talking about, pretty famous architects like Renzo Piano designing new retail structures that seemed to me to be a mall. They weren't calling them malls, but they were definitely malls. And I wanted to delve into the history of shopping centers and malls and figure out why they were so popular and what was still good about them.
Now, there's one key figure, an immigrant design person responsible for the mall in its modern form, Victor Gruen. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right. Can you tell us a bit about his role in the creation of what we think of as the mall?
Sure. It's Victor Gruen. That's right. He is really the father of the shopping mall. He was a Jewish emigre from Vienna. He fled the Nazis in 1938 and came to America. And he was somebody who started designing department stores and quickly realized that the new suburbs needed a place for people to go. They needed a new downtown. And the way that they were being built, there was no main street. And he thought, what if we can get the department store owners to move from downtown to these suburban areas and build a whole main street around their store? And the first shopping mall was built in Edina, Minnesota in 1956, and that's Southdale. And it basically has this central court that has climate control, it has daylighting, and it has a little Viennese-style cafe off to the side because he thought that's what Americans needed.
The idea was that, hey, this is in some ways a public space, but protected from the weather, accessible to people in this area. Talk about Victor Gruen's vision for what he hoped the mall would be.
Yeah, I mean, Southdale, some of the initial advertising trumpeted the fact that there would be 365 shopping days a year, because you know this in Wisconsin too. In the winter, nobody wants to go shopping outdoors. So the mall provided indoor year-round shopping, and it was also supposed to serve as kind of a community gathering space. Those initial malls especially often had sculpture, they had a carousel for the kids, they had cafes, and they basically had stores that would serve all of the needs of what was often the mother living in the suburbs who had to do a bunch of errands with kids tagging along. But he also felt like they should have a public role. Some of those early malls had community rooms or churches, and people, in his view, just needed a place to come together.
You write that part of the appeal of malls in these suburban areas was it was a place where you wouldn't run into poor people on the streets. You wouldn't worry about the crime, say, in a downtown area. And in many suburbs with restrictive zoning laws, you wouldn't run into black people at a mall. This was not all a happy thing in some ways.
Right. That is definitely true. Malls are in some ways a manifestation of white flight from central cities. And many of the neighborhoods around the malls would have restrictions on who could buy the housing. So even if the malls weren't specifically designated as a white space, they would have been a white space because only white people lived around them. And because they are, in fact, private property, they could be regulated, maintained, et cetera, to kind of a higher standard and a more restricted standard than you would get in downtowns, which are actually public space.
Talking to Alexandra Lang about her new book, Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have fond or less than fond memories of spending time at a mall? Did you go to them a lot in their heyday? Do you still go to your local community shopping mall? If not, what replaced it to meet your shopping needs? Do you miss anything about having a place with a big fountain in it and all the mall-like amenities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra, malls were super successful, right, for a long time. Can you talk about malls at their peak?
Malls at their peak, they were building basically hundreds of malls per year because every suburb needed one. And during the time when they were at their peak, people did a lot of really kind of fun and innovative things with them. I think the innovation that most people are familiar with is the Mall of America, which put an entire roller coaster in the center of the mall, you know, no fountain, but a roller coaster. So there was this sense that malls had to kind of top themselves and that they were also competing in the fashion marketplace for the newer, better, you know, kind of more technologically advanced mall. And that's a really fun period to study, basically, you know, leading through the 80s and into the early 90s.
I listed a few causes of a decline for malls, and we've seen that in a lot of places around the country. One was, you write, they just built a lot of malls, maybe too many malls. How did we end up with a glut?
Well, the short answer to that is capitalism. Basically, mall developers saw where a mall had been successful but was maybe getting a little tired looking and just built a new mall 10 miles away in a fresher suburb and sucked all of the business from that older mall to the newer mall rather than building one in a place that hadn't had a mall. So then you get two malls, one's doing well, one's on a slow decline, and may eventually die. So I think that over competition and kind of lack of imagination and where to open new malls really doomed a lot of them.
Talking to Alexandra Lang, design critic. Her new book is Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. We're looking at malls past, present, and future. And yes, she says there is a future. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is in store for the future of American shopping malls? Maybe they look different now, laid out differently. We'll get into that in just a bit. Are you now or have you ever been a mall shopper or have you worked at malls? Do you have an experience you would like to share? Do you have a question about how they've changed over the years? And hey, do you have a mall that is unused or disused in your community? What would you like to see happen to it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about shopping malls, their history, their design, their future. Alexandra Lang is with us, design critic. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you go to malls in your heyday? Did you make plans to meet someone by the fountain or the food court or you name it? Are malls part of the distant past for you or part of the present in how and where you shop? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra, one key point I take away from your book is, yeah, we might keep saying malls are dead or dying. Malls are not dead, and they're not necessarily dying. Why? Make the case for us.
Well, some malls are dying, but even the most doomsday predictions by retail experts still indicate that there are probably going to be 700 to 800 healthy malls in the U.S., which still seems like a heck of a to me. Those malls tend to be like newer malls, malls with higher end department stores, and those have really held on to their customer base and are still offering something that people want. I think the dead mall narrative was really spurred by a lot of actually often very beautiful photography of dead malls that went viral, and people just kind of extrapolated from that and were like, okay, malls are over.
We heard from Ravana on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who says they always hated the mall, but sometimes when they went to their local one, there was a survey company in it. Ravana learned to spot the surveyors to participate in surveys, be sure to walk by them so they could take a survey and get cash or coupons for the food court. Says, made having to be in the mall a little better. I got, I know I did a soda challenge at a mall one time. I intentionally picked the wrong one and I didn't get the free soda. I was just being ornery. But Alexandra, you know, that reminds me, like, the question of whether a mall is a public space. A survey company might set up shop there. Can protesters set up shop at a mall? Can, you know, is this really a public sphere we can go into and interact with people? Has been a question over the years.
It has. And that the answer to that question actually varies state by state. The first legal case around whether a mall was public space and could be used for public protest actually occurred in 1968. And Thurgood Marshall wrote the opinion, the majority opinion, and said that malls should be available for protest because they were becoming the new main street. Now, over the years, that right has been whittled away, and now it really depends where you're located whether or not you can protest at the mall.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. KB is with us in La Crosse. KB, hello.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
What did you want to tell us about?
Hey, I just wanted to mention I, in a previous life, worked in Rosedale Mall up in Roseville, Minnesota, and it was a blast. I actually loved that job because of the network of other employees in other shops. It got to the point where we'd all make friends with each other and stuff and offer each other our employee discounts, kind of like a whole barter system kind of thing. You know, I worked in a record shop and CDs and video games and stuff. And, you know, there'd be the girl down the hall who worked in a hair salon, and she'd do my hair, and I'd give her my employee discount for her CD that she wanted, you know, so David Bowie specifically, you know, kind of thing. You know, it's kind of cool.
KB, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. I worked at a mall for some years, and I got pretty good deals on some Sbarro's breadsticks, not going to lie. Alexander, the people who work at malls, a community, KB says. I don't know if you've looked at the mall workers that much, but it's a unique kind of place to work.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories like that, often from people that were hanging out at malls anyway as teens and then thought, hey, I should get a job here too. But I think that's a great kind of tribute to the fact that the mall can be a community space. Yes, we tend to focus more on the consumers, but having all of those businesses in proximity is part of what makes malls great. And the workers are really just taking advantage of the same kind of proximities as customers are.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Alexandra Lang. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Alexander, maybe my favorite chapter was your last one. I think of malls as American, and not so much anymore. You surveyed some malls around the world, and they're kind of taking us to mall school.
They are. One of my favorite examples in that chapter is from the Philippines, where the malls are all basically the same size as the Mall of America. And they are very often on light rail lines. They will have government offices in them. They're basically like satellite cities all under one roof. And I think, especially if we're going to try to densify cities and inner ring suburbs, thinking of the mall as something that can truly be an urban hub is a great way to go. But it would require us sort of like opening our eyes to what's happening elsewhere in the world with malls.
And one interesting bit of motivation, I think it was Chile, you gave an example where if I own a mall, I can get a pretty good tax break if I host a museum or a library or other public institution.
Exactly. That is true in Chile. And actually, it's also true in the U.S. I got a message from a public library in Maryland that is located in the mall. They started as just a kind of like check-in, check-out mini branch, and the mall said, oh, you're doing so well, like, let's give you 30,000 square feet. And now it's one of the most popular branches in the county.
I want to look at some of the ways malls or the spaces they are on are changing. I've seen a lot of malls around the state here go from the all indoor enclosed to doing some redesign and, you know, having an outdoor street and you enter the buildings from outside. So outdoorizing these indoor malls. Is that a trend everywhere in the country?
That is a trend everywhere in the country. It's generally, you know, more popular in the South and in California, where the weather is nicer year-round. But that is definitely a trend. I also think, you know, something that's really important is there's been the demise of a lot of department stores. And so as malls try to reposition themselves, coming up with other uses for those department store spaces, things that people really do want to leave their house for, is super important. And some of the most important things in those categories that I've seen are food, you know, food halls, food marketplaces, and also kind of family fun like trampoline parks.
And another change that seems to be going on, well, grocery stores are part of malls more and more now, you write, but also malls, including on their grounds, residential stuff, maybe upstairs or maybe on the outskirts.
Yeah, a lot of people are suddenly realizing that malls have way too much parking. And what can we do with especially the parking lots around the edges of the malls where maybe we want to start making nicer, more pedestrian streets? And those are really ripe for building housing, especially kind of townhouses, low-rise apartment buildings in places that really need to build more residential.
We heard from Charlie in Eau Claire who couldn't stay on the line. Charlie grew up in the 70s. She says the name of the book is fantastic. Threw her right back into her childhood. Charlie remembers going to Hot Sam's and Orange Julius to eat with friends. Yeah, you when you started thinking, should I write a book about malls? People were very quick to share their mall memories with you, right?
Yeah, and as an architecture critic, like, I want to write about things, buildings, designs that people have feelings about. And so malls just felt like this great untapped resource that, oh, people love this architecture, even if they've never thought about it as architecture.
You mentioned untapped resources, and you write about malls that are more or less completely defunct, actually being potentially great opportunities to use that land, but in different ways. What kind of things are you seeing?
Well, one of my favorite examples is Austin Community College, their Highland campus in Texas, where an entire community college moved into a defunct mall, and they have built new residential housing in the parking lots. And they actually now have enough space so that they've invited the local public TV station to have their offices, you know, in one of the former department stores. And so it's becoming this whole mixed-use community and a center for students when before it was just this big dead mall.
What are you watching for? Now, I mentioned the glut of malls. There's also big box stores challenging them, internet shopping, the pandemic, and more. What are some of the big trends you're watching for now in 2022 when it comes to the malls you've been researching for so long?
I think the major trend is that kind of mixed-use redevelopment, saying, okay, like, we still want to have retail here. People, you know where it is, know what to shop for here. But what else can we do with the parking lot? What other kinds of things can we invite into this space, whether those are medical facilities or churches or kind of the upscale supermarkets that you can eat in, that will really bring people out of their houses and allow them to kind of get together in an air-conditioned space, a space with a fountain, a space maybe with indoor plants.
And one thing that struck me, it seems like nowadays mall, for people who are building malls, maybe a four-letter word. It seems like some of the people you want to talk to want to call their thing anything but mall.
That is so true. Let's see, what did they try to tell me? They called it a vertical retail center. They called it like a piazza. They called it a marketplace. But I just felt like people know what a mall is. Like, when I say mall, you know what I'm talking about. And if I say vertical retail center, it's like, what?
Alexandra, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Alexandra Lang is a design critic. She joins us today for a look at her new book. It's called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. Still time for you to share your mall memories, if any, whether they go back 3 decades or 3 minutes. Let us know what you think about malls, past, present, and future. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And hey, if you have a building that we would typically have called a mall in years past that's getting used differently now, where some of the space is getting used in a different way than straight up retail, love to hear about that too. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then perceptions about religion and politics in the U.S. don't always match reality. We'll talk to the author of a new book about church attendance, abortion, and we'll bust some myths along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.